Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Matt DiGeronimo. Matt is a writer, he is a thinker, and he is an operations leader. He retired after a 20-year career in the Navy as a lieutenant commander serving on nuclear submarines. He's the author of two books. He writes frequently on his Beyond Platitudes Substack, and he prefers to focus on what matters, not what's impressive. And I really enjoyed this conversation as we got to talk a little bit of philosophy, a little bit of perspective, a whole lot of leadership and communication as he shares his lessons both from the Navy and from business. And his Navy experience, too, is pretty unique when you think about being stuck on a submarine that far underwater for sometimes, as he said, over 100 days at a time with a group of people. So he's going to share tons of great lessons and experiences with us, like how it is so important to develop a questioning mentality. I love that. He's going to talk about how he overcame his personal distaste for small talk. I mean, we run into lots of people that don't necessarily enjoy it, but there's tons of value there. He's going to talk about how he conditioned himself to recognize the importance of small talk. He's going to talk about how we need to leverage our moments of high impact and why leaders should take off their rank in important conversations with their team. And that's not just in the military, that's in the private sector as well. It's a great conversation. It's a deep conversation, and I'm really thrilled to share it with all of you today. Thank you so much for coming back for another episode. We really appreciate you being here. While you're here, take a second, please like the show, subscribe to it, share it. We truly appreciate it. And while you're online, please take some time to check out our sponsors. Head over to humantel.com. That's where you can start developing the skill set to understand what people are likely thinking and feeling by accurately interpreting changes in their facial expressions and body language to identify shifts in their emotion. While you're there, enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the training of your choice over at humantel.com. For the professional interview, viewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can get all your questions answered about the certified forensic interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify? How do you earn the designation? What could it mean for your career moving forward? That's also where you can learn about the International Association of Interviewers. What do you get from the association? How can you contribute to it? What are the networking opportunities and more? All of that at certifiedinterviewer.com. And finally, while you're online, please check out inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and more to teach them the strategic observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to uncover hidden value in all of their high impact conversations. We really appreciate you being here for another week. Thank you so much. So now, without further ado, we introduce to you Matt DiGeronimo. Hello, Matt. It's great to meet you. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
I'm well, Michael. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. I was getting really excited, looking forward to this conversation, getting prepared, doing a little bit of research. I always enjoy talking to people who have unique backgrounds and take lessons or experiences that they've learned in one or two, three other areas and apply them to different places to share them with different people. And I don't want to jump to it too quickly, but just reading a little bit about what you wrote and reading a little bit about what you've written. Here I am. I can't speak English and we're 5 seconds into this conversation and how you position yourself. I think I really like your philosophical approach to things and I'm excited to dive into it. But to start the conversation, I believe you are officially the first person with a degree in nuclear engineering that I have ever spoken with. So we can cross that one off the bucket list. But you spent 20 years in the Navy. You were a lieutenant commander, if I'm saying that correctly, on a nuclear submarine. So you spent a lot of time in confined spaces with a group of individuals underwater. So if we may, I'd like to start the conversation there. What, as the astute observer that you are, what are some of the biggest leadership lessons that you learned on a submarine that still carry through for you today?
Great question. I think, you know, it's interesting. In my transition to the civilian world, every once in a while, someone will say something like, well, Matt, it's different here. In the military, people had to do what you told them to do because it was an order, right? And there's some truth to that. But on a submarine, it's a little different. I mean, once those hatches shut and you're, you know, the longest I've been submerged was over 100 days.
Wow.
You know, there's no You can't give people a bonus. You can't send them home early. There's very little incentives. There's, you know, we'll call them carrots. And as a consequence, sticks don't work very well, right? So I really think it was a good breeding ground for developing pure leadership, because a couple things. So one is, someone very early in my career told me that, you know, these guys won't care how much you know until they know how much you care, right? Probably heard that before. So it was really important on a submarine to get to know people at a very personal level, right? I mean, people have left their families behind, so it's important to know, hey, you know, how many kids do you have? What are their names? What are they into? What are they up to? Have you gotten any letters? And that's difficult for me, because I'm not by nature a small talk kind of guy. But what I realized was that is absolutely integral, because you need trust with folks before anything you say really matters. So building that trust, I could go on all day, but maybe I'll hit three things. That's one. The other one is, I talk about loyalty up and down the chain. And what I mean by that is, and I used to talk about it to folks, if somebody that works for me comes up to me and says, hey, we have a problem and we could do A or B. And in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, we got to do A. But he says, and I intend to do B. All right, well, let's talk about it. And I'm always of the belief that, you know, I want the person who's in charge of something to own it. And if you give them the solution, now they don't own it anymore, right? So anyway, let's just say, I say, okay, let's do B. And then B blows up. Hopefully not literally.
You took the joke right out of my mouth. On a sub, I hope not.
I promise my people, like, I will never say, oh yeah, well, that was his decision, and that's, you know, it's mine, right? I mean, I had the opportunity to stop it. I own it. It's mine. And I think my guys had a lot of psychological safety because of that. They knew that, you know, they could come up with ideas, they could try different things, they could be innovative, which is challenging to do on a submarine where there's procedures for everything, but there's more opportunities than you might think. And then the reverse is true in the other direction. So if I'm talking to one of my direct reports on a submarine and I say, hey, we're going to do A and here's why. And he says, well, that's the dumbest idea I ever heard and here's why. And we go back and forth. If we leave with, we're going to do A, I think, and we see it all the time, it is so damaging to the trust in the organization if that person goes back to his guys and says, look, I know this is a stupid idea, but, you know, this is what the engineer wants, so this is what we're going to do, blah, blah, blah. Like, he's just sabotaged the whole trust in the chain of command, right? Like, he needs to be able to say, hey, this is what we're doing, I support it. And then kind of move on. And then I guess in the interest of time, I'll just leave it at with one more thing. And that's developing in myself and in others a questioning attitude. That's a very big topic in the submarine community, that our minds need to be engaged at all times, right? And if our minds are engaged, we're going to have questions. And having the courage to raise our hand and say, hey, I don't understand this, or hey, I think something is wrong with this. Can we stop for a second? That's not easy to do, especially on a submarine where the capital, if you will, or the currency, if you will, tends to be knowledge. So everyone kind of wants to be the guy who knows the stuff, but any mistake, and I've been through this before, can have dire consequences. So you have to get the crew comfortable with being uncomfortable and stepping up and asking the hard questions when they think of them.
That's a tremendous point, and one that I want to come back and spend a whole lot of time on. I wrote that down, develop a questioning attitude. I love that, and I want to circle back to that. There's one thing you said previous that I want to address before I forget. But just even on that point of, you know, speaking your mind, engaging your mind, everybody has a voice, the dire consequences. There's times, depending on who I work with, well, I'll use like the crew resource management from the airline industry as, mm-hmm. as tools to teach leadership communication. And it's, I don't know, sickening, sad, depressing. Like, how many aviation disasters could have been avoided if the captain would have listened to the crew, or the crew felt like they had a voice to speak to the captain? Like, thousands 100%. Of people would still be alive if that one problem could have been solved. And, you know, and maybe you didn't have thousands of people on a submarine, but I imagine it was even more of an acute situation for you to deal with there. But before we get to the developing the questioning mind, you mentioned kind of in passing that you weren't a small talk guy, but you knew that getting to know people was critical for developing the trust in the relationships. And if you're going to be trapped on a sub with people for 100 plus days, like, those relationships are going to become important. I feel like, and I'm sure, if you don't, correct me at any point in time, please. But as I work with leaders in particular, the concept of small talk can rub them the wrong way. Like, I'm a operations guy, I'm a task oriented guy, I'm a strategy guy, I'm here to drive numbers, I'm here to drive outcomes. I don't have time. I don't see the need for small talk. And whether they don't like to do it, or whether they rationalize themselves out of it, they skip over like what could be a very important part of the relationship, not just convincing people or showing them that you care, but also gathering intelligence that 100%. Might come in handy at another time. So, if I may say, as a self-confessed, not small talk kind of guy, how beyond just understanding it was important for trust, how did you get yourself beyond that and into the habit of, I hate this word because it's used too much, but authentically having that small talk and making connections with people?
Honestly, it's not easy for me, but I know it's important. And I think the critical piece for me was observing that we've all heard the following. Hey, you got to tell people the why, right? So if you're going to implement something, you got to tell people the why. And I get it. I would rather know the why than not know the why. However, it's been my observation that that's asking a lot, meaning you're telling people change your motivation to match the company's motivation so you can get to their why. And what I found is small talk brings out people's whys, right? And I would much rather be able to present a new initiative or a new policy or routine or whatever the case may be, and do my best to frame it in their why, not my why, right? And so the only way to really get there, if you just walk up to someone and say, hey, what's your why? Well, you're going to get some bullshit, or excuse my language. Whereas if you kind of get to know them and let them open up, you can figure that out. Right. So, to me, it forced me to get uncomfortable for the betterment of not only the individuals who, I had the responsibility and honor of leading, but also for the organization.
It's a tremendous way to look at it. And if people don't enjoy it for the personal reason, you know, there are the strategic reasons or the outcome oriented reasons. And if the outcome means enough to me, then I'll change my behavior in order to make those connections. And you're spot on. Would it be if you have round numbers, 100 people that are answering to you, is it easier to change all 100 of them to align in one why, or is it easier to adapt our message to 100 different whys? And it's actually easier to adapt the message for each one of the people. So that's a great illustration. I appreciate that. Before I forget, let's get back to developing that questioning mind. One of the things that I read about you as we were preparing was questioning conventional wisdom, mm-hmm. which is, you know, something that I think is important. Maybe not going conspiracy theory route, right? But let's question what's going on around us, gather more intel, make better decisions. Don't just always assume what we're being told. And I also saw something that you wrote, which was, and again, correct me if I'm saying this wrong, but focus on what matters, not what's impressive.
Right.
And I like that a lot. And I feel like all of that works into this questioning mindset. So let's stay here for as long sure. as you want. Even for sure. me as a dad, like one of the promises I made, he doesn't know I made it, but to my son, was I will answer every single question he asks, because I want him to feel like he can ask anything at any time and he's going to get the truth and he's going to learn from it and we'll be better for it. So I guess to start, how did you learn to develop a questioning mindset?
Yeah, so I mean, definitely part of it was the Navy. You know, I had an experience as a young officer that I can condense down a bit here. It was right after 9/11. I was on the USS Hampton, and we were preparing to deploy overseas. So we're doing a lot of exercises, which can be pretty intense. Based on just the way the Navy trains, it feels like the real thing. And I was the communications officer, very young junior officer. And but the control room is much smaller than people imagine. So you're shoulder to shoulder with, you know, 2 to 3 people. And one of the people I was shoulder to shoulder with was the weapons officer. And we had what's called a totem, which is it looks like a Tomahawk missile. It's the same size as a Tomahawk missile. You can load it into a torpedo tube, but it's really just a fancy computer system that integrates with our fire control system to maximize training value. Well, the WEPS gave the order to shoot tube 2, thinking it was empty and it could just be a water slug. You know, where you just fill the tube with water. And the fire control technician said, "No, sir, there's a totem in tube 2. And the weapons officer he was very aggressive kind of guy, certainly, you know, 6 or 7 years senior to me. And I thought there was a totem in tube 2 as well. And he just kept saying, "Tube 2 is empty, shoot tube 2. And finally, the fire control technician, you know, had to follow a lawful order. And he launched this totem into the ocean, you know. So not only, I mean, it's a bad day for a submarine when you accidentally launch something out of a submarine, right? I mean, think about what it could have been. But what really haunted me was I knew the right answer the whole time. I was standing right there. And I did not have the courage at that point in my life or career to just say, stop. It's an exercise. Just stop. Let's figure this out. And I've had to live with that. I mean, I probably think about that at least once a week where my 9-to-5 is in some high risk industries. And so I do have to understand very well why I didn't have that questioning attitude or willingness to. And if I can address that, then I can address, well, how do I create an environment that's kind of maximizes the chance of people saying something? And you know, there's a lot of meat on that bone, but I think, you know, one of the more significant things is, and again, I don't like these types of terms either, but I can't think of a different one, is, you know, making it psychologically safe.
Yeah.
Where, you know, when you don't jump down someone's throat when they say, like, let's say I was wrong, you know, let's say their tube was empty, just like the weapons officer thought, right? And if I just stop it, you know, I don't want to deflect here, but let's assume it's somebody else and, you know, give them a pat on the back. Like, hey, that took a lot of courage. I mean, you're wrong, but that's okay. You know, it's okay because you displayed the courage to do that. And if we're not looking for opportunities to celebrate a questioning attitude, whatever you get is just a mere coincidence.
I like that, celebrate the questioning attitude. We shouldn't be taking it as a threat. We shouldn't be taking it as an attack. I mean, I guess there's a productive and unproductive way to ask questions. We could break that one down too. But the fact that somebody's asking us questions, we shouldn't take as an assault on our self-image or our authority or our leadership. So celebrating people asking questions is a great one. You mentioned creating the environment to help drive that questioning mindset. What are some other ways that you have worked to help create that environment?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that is so simple, but so instrumental, is leveraging moments of high impact, right? So for example, when somebody starts a new job, in that first 48 hours, any conversation you have with that person is high impact. And you're making sure that in that first 48 hours, they have a one-to-one conversation in a quiet place with no distractions, where we talk about this topic exactly, right? I mean, sometimes I've even shared my story about the totem, where I say, hey, it's not a matter of if this is going to happen to you. It's a matter of when. And I need to plant the seed right now in your brain to say that when that time comes, there'll be no neon lights. It's not going to knock very loudly, but your spidey sense is going to tingle. And when it does, you have the responsibility, not just the authority, but the responsibility and the obligation to do something about it. And obviously one conversation, this is not a one and done, but I think having that conversation early in, well, as someone joins the team, I mean, it's the type of thing that they'll go home and tell their wife, right? Be like, hey, you know, this, you know, plant manager or VP pulled me aside and he had this, you know, it'll impact them. The other thing that we did, which I think reasonable people will disagree on the effectiveness of this, but on a submarine, what we used to do was we would run drills. Obviously, we run a lot of fire drills, flooding drills, that type of stuff, but we would run drills to test an individual. So, for example, coming to periscope depth on a submarine is one of the more dangerous things that we do. I think because of movies, most people think we know exactly what's up there, and we don't. We try, but it's hard. And if you're in a high traffic area and you're going to come up to the surface, like, that's tough to do it safely. And so we'll drill where everyone's briefed except one or two people. And let's say I'm the officer of the deck and I say, okay, attention and control, I intend to come to periscope depth on course 030. And 030 is a very dangerous course. And we're just waiting. Are they going to say anything? You know, are they going to, you know, might be the sonar technicians or the fire control technicians. And if they don't say anything, we just say, or if they do say something, we just say, okay, secure from the drill. That was a drill. Let's talk about it. You know, like, did you realize that 030 was a dangerous course? Yes. Okay. Let's talk about why you didn't say anything, right? Because I don't think PowerPoints and lectures are enough to drive this topic home. You know, and I think about, well, what would it have taken for me to have acted differently in the scenario that I just shared? And I do really believe if those couple things had happened, like if someone had a real conversation with me about it, or somebody had kind of drilled, you know, if I had seen that, because in this particular case, we didn't start doing that until after this event. Because, you know, investigations always pull out stuff. And our stuff was that we had a lack of a questioning attitude in the crew. So, I mean, those are the two things that come to mind.
And they all work together very well. And there were probably more than two in there. Is it all one? I just threw my pen across my desk as we wind that conversation together. But even, I think it's powerful. Obviously, it's your story, it's not mine. But whether you use the tube story or whether you use another story, like, here's a situation where I should have asked a question and I didn't. Here's what I learned from it. Here's why you need to ask me questions. Like, mm-hmm. So it even helps drive it more where it's not just me saying the thing that I'm supposed to say as a new leader, like tap on your shoulder, haha, check the box, we said it. No, like legit, like here's a situation that I regret not saying anything. It took me a long time to understand why and change from it. Go make a different mistake. Don't repeat mine. Here's my expectations. You got to ask me. That lands different. So those conversations are super important. And you talk about those high impact moments. I think often as leaders, we don't recognize what's high impact for our audience as well as we used to. So for us, onboarding somebody new might be Wednesday. But for the person who's onboarding is new, that could be a really big deal. So to buy them lunch and to have that conversation makes a huge difference because as a leader, you're a celebrity in your organization. But I do for... I'll go on the reasonable side of thinking the drills were a good idea, at least with the way it was just explained, because often, you know, you would know better than me being in many circumstances that I haven't, but we don't know how we're going to react until we're in that situation. Yeah. So to your point, it's one thing for me to ask you in the classroom, what would you do in this situation? And if you're half asleep, you'll give me the right answer. But if we call the course and then ask you after, well, that was a real thing that you didn't know was a drill. Why didn't you speak up? The effectiveness of that, I think the learning anchors that it sets,
right,
is much
more
important.
Interesting that you choose that word, right? So, you know, the related to questioning attitude is the formulation or the creation of a learning organization, right? Are we always learning? And, you know, to me, that is what the best organizations do, right? You know, it's pretty common for a lot of reasons, some of which are reasonable. When something goes sideways, you know, we do our best to clean it up and then we just move on with life. And we generally are apt to say something to the effect of, well, that guy was trained and he knew what to do and he just made a mistake. And, you know, or worse, hey, you know, this guy needs to be disciplined or something because he made a mistake. And it's not my experience that that's how learning organizations do things, right? I mean, it's, if anything, you know, we should be thankful that nobody got hurt. And I'm hesitant to use the word celebrate. Maybe leverage is a better word, but we have to leverage our mistakes because, yeah, you know, in the Navy, we call them critiques. In the civilian world, sometimes they're called RCAs or root causes, whatever you want to call it. But the discussion after something didn't go as planned, I think, is instrumentally valuable to the organization's health. For so many different reasons, right? Just like that drill in the control room, it didn't impact the two fire control technicians who we were testing. It impacted everybody in the control room, right? Because they knew, like, hey, this is an important thing. It wouldn't, if it wasn't important, we wouldn't be drilling on it, right? The fact that we're taking time to do this means it's important. Sometimes I use the football analogy where if you look at a football team, which I think is a perfect example of a learning organization, by the way, at least the good ones, they practice for 40 hours to play a 4-hour game, and then they watch 8 hours of film, right? So if I were to reduce that down as a ratio, you know, I get 10-1-2 for planning, execution, and evaluation. And far be it for me to tell anyone what the right ratio is for their game, but I know what it's not. It's not 0x0. And that's kind of what I see in a lot of places, right? There's not a lot of preparation. We do the job and then we move on to the next one. And many companies are good, or organizations are good, who do that, right? But I think the great ones know that there'll always be a debrief, and it doesn't have to be painful and it doesn't have to be long. But just something that talks about, hey, what didn't go as expected? You know, what could we have improved upon? Did we have any near misses? Just those conversations. Because if you don't have them, in my opinion, let's say something goes sideways, but it's not that big of a deal. By sitting at a table and having all different ranks of the organization, you know, just kind of take off the rank and just some people sitting around a table talking about, hey, this didn't go as expected. What should we do different in the future to ensure it does? That only works if people have the muscle memory or that it's in their DNA that, hey, this is what we do. We talk and we're honest. And otherwise, people clam up. And if they clam up, well, then you know, you're kind of wasting your time. And I've seen that in organizations where people are very comfortable with that. And it's remarkable. And I've been in organizations where people just resist it tooth and nail. And they'll just sit there in silence, you know, and to me, that's a red flag about the culture of the organization.
Yeah. That's a whole set of red flags.
Yeah.
Something that you said there, and you kind of said it in passing, but just take off your rank.
Yeah.
If we really want to connect with people, you know, says the guy that was never in the military, by the way, but if really want to connect with people, even in the private sector as a leader, sit around the table, take off your rank. And that can be, let somebody else lead the conversation. That can be where you position yourself in the room, like how you dress that day. Like there's who gets the coffee first? Like, all of these things can help take your rank off in order to help people open up and participate in the conversation. And the part about celebrating mistakes or leveraging mistakes, I couldn't agree with more. I mean, that's where our brains are primed to learn the most. And to your point, let's be thankful nobody got hurt. You know, I say this metaphorically, it wasn't a fatal mistake, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, we survived. We made the adjustments. Let's learn. Blame has never solved the problem ever. So let's get past that. What's the likelihood we're going to run into the same or similar problem again? You can set your watch to it. So now let's separate the process from the results. What were we thinking? What were our goals? How are we moving towards that? How do we adapt it to get better for the next time? It's critical. And it's, I would guess, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this too. There's something else I wanted to touch back on. But when the leaders are open to that themselves, when they make a mistake and they subject themselves to the after action conversations, how could I have done it better? Now they're really taking off their rank and leading by example that everybody needs to be open to this, 100%. As opposed to just walking in the room and saying, now you need to do this.
That's right. And you hit the nail on the head, because it's people will take their signals from the senior people in the room, you know, and if the senior people in the room are behaving in such a way, you know, it's got to put the cord in my battery or my charger here, or I'll lose you. If the senior folks are behaving in such a way, it's immediately impactful to the junior people, 100%.
I feel like, this is something I had to learn a little bit the hard way early in my career, that people don't like leaders. And when I say leader, like frontline manager, top level leader, doesn't matter. If you're in a leadership role, people don't realize that hopefully if we're leading by example, that's the ceiling. Like, we want people to get all the way to where we are. And maybe they do, maybe they get close enough. Okay, cool. But I don't think what we realize is that when we don't live up to our values, our mission, the way that we're supposed to, that's actually the floor. Like, now we're giving people an opportunity not to act as bad as we are, but worse, mm-hmm. because we're the leader. So if we're expecting people to be thoughtful, be introspective, have the questioning attitude, have the courage to speak up. Something you said earlier that was spectacular that I forgot to touch on was the difference between, authority and responsibility. It might not be your authority, but it's your responsibility. The old see something, say something. But realistically, like, you were at a moment in time to impact a series of decisions that were made and the outcome that was achieved. Like, it's your responsibility to be an active participant in that. There's a thread that I think I'm picking up on as I listen to you go through all of this, which is refreshing, and I really appreciate it, that there appears to be like a self-education, a self-journey, a self-evolution that I'm sure throughout iterations of your career and your life that you've gone through. And I would imagine that somewhere through that process, learning who you are and developing who you are as a human being has then helped you reset your goals, achieve your goals, maybe even achieve bigger goals than you initially imagined. And I have to assume that throughout your leadership career, you've helped other people go through that process as well. So from your experience, how has understanding yourself or developing yourself first really helped you set yourself up, or those who worked with you, to achieve greater goals?
Phenomenal question. So, and I think that at the core of your question is the answer to all that ails us. And so it's simple, but it's not easy. And it's about, you know, digging pretty deep inside of ourselves. And, you know, I talk about internal congruence or internal integrity, where who we believe we are, who we want to be, and our actions, those three things need to be in alignment with each other. And if they're not, that's where we get into things like self-sabotaging our goals, right? Because you have different parts of yourself that have different motivations, and then they start to kind of compete, and we can't really figure out what's going on, why we're on the couch with a bag of Cheetos watching Seinfeld reruns when we told ourselves yesterday we were going to be at the gym, right? So, and that confuses us. And I think that comes back to creating alignment. And it doesn't have to be a perfect person that we're creating. Like, I have plenty of faults, and some of them I'm not willing to address right now, right? So, and that's okay. But it's the process of being honest with ourselves. And I think the consequence of that a seed was planted in my head years ago. I went through a divorce, and in the aftermath of the divorce, and I was doing a lot of self-reflection, I had read something that said, stop looking for Mr. or Mrs. Right and start becoming Mr. or Mrs. Right. And that planted a seed in my head that kind of grew into a bigger thought and just to throw it out there, eventually a book about, like, let's stop assessing these external goals as somehow the thing that we want, and instead start talking about the person we want to be, because the person we want to be will naturally gravitate, those goals will gravitate to us. Like they'll just happen. If you can get yourself to behave in a way that you are building yourself, like, we don't need smaller goals. We need a bigger self to carry those bigger goals. Right. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why this book Actualization, I just published it, but I had written it years ago and I didn't feel strong enough to carry the message in the book. I just didn't, you know, and it took me some time to get there. And I think I'm there now. Obviously I published it, so maybe I am, but I've taken that perspective very seriously, and it leads to some pretty uncomfortable places. Like, as you start to dig and you say, well, why do I want this? Like, if you're honest, you find out some stuff about yourself that you probably knew, but you had, buried a little bit. And the deeper we can go, we can say, okay, this is what I'm really trying to achieve, right? This is the person I want to become. Those other things are sometimes even self-soothing mechanisms. So that's, that's part of it. And then the other part that I'll share, because you mentioned it earlier about conventional wisdom, like I am enemy number one of conventional wisdom. And I think it's because I view conventional wisdom as the average of the past. So did it work-ish to get us where we are at? Yeah. But I wouldn't drive my car just looking at the rearview mirror, right? The only way that would work is if the road I'm driving on is exactly the same as the road that I came from. So, I'm not going to wrap myself up around the average of the past. I want the exceptional of the future. And, to me, that means you have to just sort of abandon conventional wisdom, or at least question it.
That quote, conventional wisdom is the average of the past, is the quote of the day, probably the quote of the week for me. I think that's a great way to put it. And for me, I've got a t-shirt on the back. Well, I probably have multiple with something similar on the back, but one in particular that just says question authority. And even with my son, that he's young, but I'm trying to teach him how to think. I'm trying to teach him how to problem solve. I'm trying to teach him how to be situationally aware, realize what's going on around him all the time. And even little things like if we pull into the airport parking lot and the sign says park to the right, well, Dad, why are you going to the left? Because everybody getting here is parking to the right and people have been leaving from the left. So there's probably a better parking spot on the left. Like, let's use our independent brains here. So when I talk about questioning authority, that's not, giving the finger to the people who are in charge, although to be honest, sometimes I probably want to. But it's like what you're saying, just because it's always been done this way or everybody says this is the right way to do it, maybe it is. But let's investigate it first. Let's use some critical thinking. Let's be a little bit of creative here. Let's look at the outcome, separate the process from the outcome, and think it through. So I'm going to be stealing that. Well, I'm gonna attribute it to you for as long as I can remember.
I'm sure I stole it from somewhere too.
Inevitably, I'm going to end up convincing myself it was mine. But I'll attribute it to you for as long as I can. But the average of the past, I love that. I think that's awesome. As I'm listening to you tell a little bit about your story, which I certainly appreciate you sharing, again, I feel like I'm pulling on some common threads, whether it was leading in the Navy, whether it's helping people develop a questioning attitude, what you do now leading in the private sector, your own professional journey. And I'm sincerely impressed with the level of self-awareness that you're sharing here as part of the conversation. I feel like that's a rare trait these days. But I feel like, and I don't want to say this jokingly or I don't want to sound trite about it, but that these are all roller coaster journeys. Like there's times where we feel really good and there's times where we feel really bad. And you likely know better than me based on your story and your history that sometimes those hardest moments, those crucibles are the ones that we learn the most from and we're the best from. So to steal a phrase that is almost certainly came from the military, I stole it from people who served in the military. I did not. How does embracing the suck in some of these journeys that you've talked about really help create the level of awareness that drives the behaviors you're coaching?
Yeah, so another great question. And embrace the suck is definitely a military term. And, you know, it's a powerful one. It sounds a little flippant, but it's not. It's about like, yeah, of course this sucks or there's elements of this that suck. But guess what? If it wasn't that, it'd be something else, right? I mean, there's suck is always in the room with us. And, you know, you can lament his presence. You could complain about his presence, but he's always going to be there. You know, we went to, my wife and I went to see Jerry Seinfeld and Jim Gaffigan perform. It was a great night, great dinner, we had great seats, just everything seemed to be perfect. We get to our seats and there's, you know, there's a guy who's got to be 400 pounds sitting next to me. So he takes up half the chair and I'm squished the whole time, right? Well, if it wasn't that, it'd be something else, right? Somebody would have spilled a beer on me or, you know, we got into an accident in the parking lot or, you know, there's the suck is always there. So, you know, instead of running away from it, it's like we just embrace it. It's like, hey, he's part of the team.
I like your line. If it wasn't that, it'd be something else. And when you say he's part of the team, it reminds me of a line as I continue to steal military references with only respect. I didn't serve. I don't want to take anybody's clout. But my favorite college professor, who also was an advisor purely by alphabet, like I just got lumped into his advisory group because my last name started with R and that was the short straw that he drew. True. But he was a retired colonel and there was in the Army and there was, sorry to make an Army reference to a Navy man. I don't mean anything by it. But he was in one of the leadership classes he was teaching. He was talking about how there was a guy, everyone's an adult that listens to this show. He was talking about somebody that who on his team that was an asshole. And yeah, he had his problems with them and the guy was an asshole. And he's like, but I tell you what, when anybody challenged him from the outside, he was our asshole. Right. And we had to take care of him because he was part of our team and kind of helping us shift our mindset to, you know, you're not going to get along with everybody. But when you are on the same team and you are all pointed in the same direction, you know, you do take care of each other.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, sometimes those, well, two things come to mind. One is, you know, I think it was Andy Stanley who said, leaders who don't listen will soon be surrounded by people who have nothing to say. Right. So, you know, even when you have, let's call them your assholes or whatever, like those personalities actually serve a pretty good service. Right. So, and the one that comes to mind is, yeah, I think of like cave people sitting around a fire. Right. And it's at night. Pitch dark except for the fire, and there's a noise that comes from the brush, and everyone's head looks in that direction, right? And whatever comes out of that area where the noise is, we're probably going to be okay, right? Because the whole group is looking there. Where we're really susceptible to is behind us, where no one's looking. And it's those people who seem like a pain in the ass who are the ones that are pretty good about saying, hey, no one's looking over here. And it might not be every time they open their mouth, but it's more than zero times. And we have to respect that, like they're protecting us from the groupthink phenomena, right? So as much as it is painful to have someone in your group who's always saying, well, what about this? And that sucks and this and that, like you were probably better off with that person than without that person.
I agree. And it's more incumbent on the leader to be able to be situationally or contextually aware to try to parse when this is just venting or wait a minute, they're actually onto something.
That's
so
right.
If someone gets a reputation, they're always the naysayer. They're always the devil's advocate. They're always, it could be easy to write that person off. Well, whatever. That's just Mike. He's always saying this will never work. He's always bitching about something. He never wants to do it. that might be true 80 to 85% of the time. But the 15 to 20%, Mike's got a really good point. Well, if we're referencing me, it might be 5 to 10%, but whatever. Mike's got a really good point. Then we need to be listening. So being able to separate the message from the messenger becomes a whole nother level of skill that leaders can develop. So we don't just fall into that routine of he's always a naysayer. Well, maybe, but this could be a really accurate and important time to listen.
Well, 100%. I mean, think about a whole nother topic is having the courage to prevent something, right? So when you prevent something, the thing doesn't happen. So there's no parade or celebration of the thing that you prevented, right? So think of like the Challenger explosion. You know, if there was an engineer who just would not give up that the temperature was too cold for those O-rings and when he thought they were going to ignore him, he handcuffed himself to the space shuttle, right? Anything he had to do to stop that day. Yeah, it would have stopped it, but would he have been a hero or would he have been a nut job who they had to deal with and delay the launch a day for? And I'm not suggesting handcuffing ourselves to anything, but my point is it takes a lot of courage to prevent something because even when you're successful, there's no accolades, right? Yeah. And it's just a Tuesday. But it you went in high risk environments like a submarine is, leadership is preventing something every day. It's lost on us because the event didn't occur.
And this is probably a terrible word to use, but it almost becomes normal. Like it's part of the average job. My job is to prevent tragedy from striking. So if it never strikes, nobody knows. And it's just what I was supposed to do today.
That's right. That's right.
I don't know if this comes from just your personality or your story or from working in high-risk environments for so long. I guess I'll ask it this way. How did you learn to focus on what matters versus what's impressive? Because I feel like the perception of what's impressive can distract a whole lot of people.
Yeah, I think it was mostly because I was so guilty of the opposite for so long in my life. Like I was a rule follower and an achiever, right? I wanted to be class valedictorian and I was. I wanted to get a scholarship to college and I did. I was so achievement driven. But then over the years I realized I was getting no fulfillment or satisfaction at it. I mean, that was almost, if not 100%, 95% about external validation. So it really took a lot of soul searching to realize that not only for me personally, as I lead myself, but as I lead teams, it's okay to cut the noise out and focus on what really matters. In fact, I think it's an expression I believe I made up. Maybe I didn't, I don't know. It's called organizational noise. Like I think that, all of the things that are happening and the meetings and this conference and this and that, it just creates so much noise that it's hard to see the things that really matter. If we were blasting Metallica at 130 decibels into people's work environment, we wouldn't be surprised if they're not particularly productive, right?
Ironically, probably make me very productive, by the way.
Well, maybe you, but most people, I would say.
But you're right. Most people would be miserable.
Yeah, because it's noise. And and what do we do when we're lost somewhere? We turn the radio down, right? Because our brain wants to focus just on the thing.
Very good point.
And I think that in organizations, there's so much noise. And it's not malevolent, but it exists. Mm-hmm. And I think it's incumbent upon the leader or have they have the responsibility to the people who they have the privilege of leading to get rid of that noise as best as they can and focus on the two or three things that matter, right? Like if you're asking people to focus on 10 things, you might as well be asking them to focus on zero things. Because mm-hmm. it's not, and then you ask Bill, hey, what are we focused on? And he says four of them. And you ask Tom, he says two of them. And no one really knows, but if you can get people to focus on two to three things that matter, and same thing in our own lives, right? I mean, if my list of, goals and to do is a whole list, then you're probably not going to achieve any of them, right? I mean, like, we got it. Focus is the currency of success. That you have without that focus, I'm getting off topic here a little bit, but I don't know if it's a result of movies. Sometimes I think it's a result of movies, because in movies, it's an hour and a half. The main character who we love runs into a conflict, and then 20 minutes later, he's the hero. And you can only see that plot over and over and over and over and over and over again to somehow have a modification of the way we think. Like, they didn't show Rocky training every day for however many days before he fought Apollo Creed, because that would be boring. But yet in our own lives, overnight success is usually 10 years of hard work. I mean, you can look at in your industry here, Joe Rogan. How long was Joe Rogan a podcaster before anyone even knew his name? A long time, right? And so, being able to focus on what's really important, to me, is the differentiator between both self-fulfillment as an individual and effectively leading a group.
I want another home run quote. Focus is the currency of success, which immediately makes me question all the times I lost focus and the opportunities it took away. So thank you for sending me down that spiral. But I couldn't agree more. It's a great point and a great illustration. And I think about both the people I work with, and even as a dad, trying to impress upon people the importance of the mundane and the reps and the practice and how it pays off when it's not what it, especially with social media and marketing and all these things, it doesn't look like that's what other people had to do to get there, when in reality, it most certainly was. There's a phrase you've used a half a dozen times anyway in the last 45 minutes or so: the privilege of leading people. And I probably screwed it up a little bit, but you said it in different ways, different times through the conversation. As you interact with different people in the various ways that you do now, do you have approaches to try to get people in leadership roles to realize it's a privilege? I feel like we run into many who they run into that entitlement trap of, I'm in charge, 100%. I'm awesome. Yeah. How do you help people try to recognize the privilege of leading other people?
Yeah, so a couple things. One is, everywhere I've been, I always carve out at least an hour a week for whatever group I'm privileged to lead. And we do nothing but a leadership topic, right? Because we spend all types of time training on technical things and safety and OSHA requirements. But leaders should spend time each week talking about nothing but people. How do we communicate with people? In those training sessions, I like to highlight things. And the one that I highlight that I think has registered with people, and I can give them an example too, is that your behavior as a leader impacts, let's just say, John. Like, you think, like, oh, John's just working in the warehouse or whatever. And no. John's a human being with complex emotions and goals and desires. And your role as his, let's call it a boss, impacts his mood when he drives home. His mood when he drives home impacts how he treats his family. How he treats his family impacts how those kids grow up. And that can be traced back to you. Leadership is, you're affecting people that you've never met every day. In fact, the example that I give, and I had written about this not that long ago on Substack, was I got a Christmas card from the wife of an employee of mine thanking me so much for saving their relationship and his relationship with the kids. And I didn't do anything extraordinary. I mean, I think I heard him, and he had some kind of marital and family things to deal with, and we worked around that, and I knew he was happier. I didn't realize I saved his marriage, right? And so, if for every letter, that's one letter that I got, I have to imagine that there's, X number of people who feel similarly who didn't write the letter, right? So I really impress upon that element. And then the other element I impress upon people is, when you're training the junior people you're leading the junior people, you're very possibly training the leader of your son or daughter, right? Just think about the timing of it, right? I mean, like, and what kind of person do you want them, you know, entrusted in their care? And that's on you. And I think those two things combined with putting your actions where your words are in terms of, you know, carving out time to talk about it, you know, to me have been impactful to the group.
A great way to look at it, especially, well, yes, you know, you could be developing the leader that your son or daughter could work under, but even beyond that, we don't realize how many lives we're touching, the ripple effects, the butterfly effects, you know, whatever you want to call it, such an important way. I have really enjoyed this conversation and I really appreciate your perspective. And I love the fact that it doesn't just, and I'm not insulting readers, or but it didn't just come from a book, like leading people on a submarine, leading people in business, failing, succeeding, iterating, all of these things, that your perspective is one that's born from, experienced and reinforced with the philosophies and the books and the things that you have experienced along the way. So I can't thank you enough for sharing it with all of us. I've been taking notes and it certainly impacts how I think and how I'm going to try to pursue some things moving forward. So for the people that have listened to this, I know you mentioned your Substack, you mentioned your books. For people that want to stay connected with you and learn more from you, where should they go? What should they do?
Yeah. So if you're not on Substack, I recommend you get there. It's a great place where you'll meet a lot of great writers. I hope maybe I'm one of those good writers. And you can find me on Substack either by searching my name, Matt DiGeronimo, or my publication is called Beyond Platitudes. And just join me there. I mean, I have a free subscriber option. I publish essays, I would say, 4 times a week. It's a good community, and that's the easiest way to find me. If you're so inclined to want to look at my books, you could just Google my last name on Amazon, and there's 5 books there. But more importantly, I would encourage people to come find me on Substack. It's a great place, and I really enjoy it there.
I will put the direct link to your Substack. You had shared it with me. I'll put the direct link in the show notes, and I'll put the direct links to your books too. So if people are so inclined, they got a shortcut to go find them.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you for all you've done, certainly in service for our country and beyond. Thank you for everything that you taught me today. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to hopefully having the opportunity to keep in touch.
Likewise, Michael. I really appreciate having me, and yeah, let's keep in touch. This was great.
Awesome, man. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Take care.
All right.
Matt, thank you for a wonderful conversation. I really do appreciate your perspective, your introspection, how you evaluate the people and situations around you, the way that you could tie your military experience to a lot of our civilian experience. I really appreciate that. Obviously, I love developing the questioning mindset. I think that is so important for all of us throughout our lives. But I was blown away when you said conventional wisdom really equals the average of the past. I think that is a fantastic quote. I think it is dead on accurate. Thank you for sharing it. Also, actually, when I left the office, I found myself thinking if it wasn't that, it would be something else. I mean, that's another great kind of grounding perspective. Eliminating organizational noise, also so very important. And I love how you talked about focus being the currency of success. Thank you so much for the conversation. I took a bunch of notes, lots of great takeaways. I really appreciate it. Thank you. And thank you to everybody that took the time to join us today. We appreciate you being here for another hour. Thank you so very much. Hopefully that conversation help shift some of your perspectives as well. Before you go, please take just a second, like the show, share the show, subscribe to it, leave us your feedback. What would you like to hear more or less of? We'd love to hear from you, please. Also, check out our sponsors. Head over to humantel.com. Enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the online training of your choice as you develop the skills necessary to recognize what people are likely thinking and feeling by accurately identifying shifts in their emotions through their facial expressions and body language. I've done it all myself. I highly recommend it over at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, please check out certifiedinterviewer.com so we can learn everything you need to know about the International Association of Interviewers. To be honest, what's in it for you? What can you get out of it? What can you contribute to it? How can you network with other great interviewers? And so much more. That's also where you can learn all you need to know about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. Who qualifies? How do you earn it? What can it mean for your career? And more over at certifiedinterviewer.com. Inquasim.com. And finally, while you're online, please check out Inquasim.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, for their sales teams, for their HR teams, and more, as we teach them how to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences across all of their high-impact conversations. Thank you so much for being here every week. We truly appreciate it. Please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.